All right, it is time for yet another episode of Africanalysis, where we check in with JJ Cornish and find out what is happening all over the continent. It's brought to you by the Johannesburg Business School, who do know their way around the continent, and I hope by the end of this you will too. JJ, nice to see you. How are you?
Excellent, thank you.
Good. You never ever got that question wrong, so I'm always pleased when I get that respect, that answer. I have lots of respect for it. So, JJ, let's just look at a couple of things that are going on. There's never a dull day in Africa, and I know we're doing our elections, so everybody's focused on that primarily. But let's talk about Nigeria for a second, because we just don't know how they're ever going to get a grip on all these abductions that are taking place.
Well, remember, Gareth, back with the Chibok schoolgirls in 2014, when everybody, including Barack Obama's wife, you know, bring back the girls. That was 276 schoolgirls taken in Borno State. 57 escaped, 108 were rescued, and then 20 returned in the past 2 years, many of them pregnant. I mean, it's just an absolutely, their lives ruined by this. But it hasn't stopped. And successive, I mean, that was under Good Luck Jonathan. Successive presidents, Muhammadu Buhari, Umar Yar'Adua, they've all said that they would stop these abductions. Well, there was one at the weekend, 160. And the abductees, this was in Niger State, which is north central, not the northeast where the Boko Haram generally operate. So who are these people involved with? Are they joined to the Islamist groupings? That would be very, very worrying. But they arrived on motorcycles. Flags flying, and the flags look like Boko Haram flags, heavily armed. They cooked food, made tea, relaxed, and then went house to house and made these abductions. Now, the fact that they could do that and the authorities couldn't stop them just indicates that there's no way. And then now, Bola Tinubu became president last May, there have been more than 5,000 abductions, Gareth. So when we say they just don't seem to be able to get to grips with it, that's an illustration of that.
It sounds almost insurmountable, and I don't know how any government would take control of a situation like this, because clearly it's at such a complex level. You know, you've got a country that's very complicated, divided. There are interest groups who are just not interested in talking to the other side. And these are essentially terrorists. They go in. I mean, can you imagine being a mother or a father of one of these girls? It must just be the most awful, just deplorable situation imaginable.
And how do you rescue them? You know, do you go in all guns blazing and then take the bodies of the children home to their parents? You know, it's an absolutely insurmountable problem. But, you know, the fact that the presidents in turn have said, we will beat them, we will beat these guys, just adds to the frustration. And, you know, imagine saying goodbye to your child on their way to school in the morning, not being sure that they're going to be able to come back.
No, it's awful. And, you know, it's not just on the west coast of Africa that this is happening. It's happening right across the border for us in Mozambique as well, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And again, these are people that claim to be Islamists, you see. So it's part of the... But in Nigeria, it's not for ideological reasons. Or in the case of the Chibok schoolgirls, it seems to have been. But now it seems to be purely for cash. They are getting these kids, demanding ransoms, and that's the way. So it's become banditry more than ideological.
Yeah, it's a horrific situation. I don't actually know how much we can say about it that hasn't already been said. But as you say, that situation all those years ago with Michelle Obama holding up the "Bring Back Our Girls" sign, and of course nothing came of it. You had Hollywood celebrities all over the world holding up the sign. You really think Boko Haram are listening when famous people in the Western world hold up a sign? Obviously not.
I think not. No.
So, JJ, let's turn our attention to Burkina Faso, also not terribly far from there. There's been a junta there. There's been a military dictatorship. And they promised that they would return the country to constitutionality this July. How are we doing? front.
Junta, Junta, so nice. They named it twice. They had one in January where Paul-Henri Damiba took over from the elected Roch Kabore. And then in September, Ibrahim Traore took over from Damiba. Now, you know, there's been an insurgency there of jihadis who've killed thousands and displaced millions. And the traditional powers, certainly France and the other Western powers, the European Union, certainly the United States even, couldn't stop these people. And so they, in desperation, turned to the Wagner Group. And if you think the Wagner Group is going to mean any salvation, you're smoking something, because they have done nothing. Now, Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso. Burkina Faso, of course, meaning the land of the honest people, right? Now, that they are the three that have had coups. In Mali, they promised to return to constitutionality, but they've extended the junta. In Burkina Faso, Traore promised to return to constitutionality by July this year. And he's now said they had a meeting at the weekend with civil society, security forces, traditional lawmakers, but not, interestingly, not political parties. And they said, we'll carry on for 5 more years. And if we can, we'll have elections then. And, oh, by the way, I, Ibrahim Traore, I'll be standing in those elections. So, you know, I'll remove my uniform and become a politician. So it's not looking good for them, sadly. But the point is, the people they've turned to, the Wagners, who are now, since the death of their leader, they call themselves the Africa Corps. They just haven't been able to do anything, not in Mali, not in Niger, and not in Burkina Faso.
The Wagner Group seems to be the only appeal to authority these people can make. It's certainly not the UN of old. They don't seem to be able to get their teeth into things as well as they might have once before. And of course, the former colonial powers, who, by comparison, in some countries, look like they were actually a little more humanitarian, and that's comparing it to some pretty awful low standards. So, I don't know. Burkina Faso is not really on anyone's priority list, is it, JJ?
No, it isn't. You know, 22.5 million people who desperately trying to stop this jihadism, which is laying them waste. But you know, they've always had this dichotomy of ungovernability, and then the jihadis. Nothing seems to work for them. And the French, of course, when they got involved, they've been highly, highly criticized for looking for a military solution when other solutions might have worked. In other words, social solutions. Why are these people jihadis? Why are they fighting? Is it because they have no alternative? They can't have jobs. There's no other way of making a living but to become Islamist bandits. You can understand the French saying we've got to beat them, but they didn't manage to do this, and that's why they were thrown out, and they've turned to the Wagnerians or the Wagner Group, and I'm afraid they're not doing it either.
Well, I always believe, first and foremost, take people at their word, and if someone is a jihadi, then they are a true believer, and if they're a true believer, then everybody else who is not a true believer, according to that religion, is really just chattel and or hostage material and or someone who doesn't have any value. So they're doing what they said. We don't have to search for deeper meaning here, surely. And that's the case in Nigeria and in Burkina Faso. What a depressing situation.
Very much so. Very much.
So, okay, this is potentially a ray of some hope, and I don't want to gild the lily on this before we even know if there is a lily or not. But Kenya, God bless them, one of the African countries that seems to have its shit together, if you don't mind my foul language there, but they seem to more or less keep their eye on the ball. You know, they seem to be a country that's on the up and up. They're not a desperate, miserable dictatorship that's being ruined like the two previous countries we spoke about just now, not even dictatorships, but countries that are being beset by really awful things. I mean, they've had their share, but mostly it's a stable place. Would you agree?
Yes. I mean, they have a lot of criminality, but the sort of criminality we have that you've got, yeah. And they have economic problems. But Kenya, the president was invited to Washington last week. He was a guest in Washington, and Joe Biden met him. And that was essentially to say thank you for offering to go to Haiti. You know, Haiti, of course, when you look at it, remember you, Thabo Mbeki spoke about Haiti being part of the African diaspora. You know, they've had independence. The freed slaves in Haiti started a revolution. 13 years later, the French said, okay, that's enough.
That's right.
We're giving up. 1804, and they've been independent since 1804. They're the first black country to get independence. Now, the thing about it, then they came up with a massive debt that they said France owed them. Because when I reported it, the French were absolutely furious. How can you report a thing like that? You know it can't be true. And I said, the foreign minister said it was. And if your foreign minister tells me something, I would report that too. And I know that will infuriate other people, but this is the way it works in newspapers. Anyway, so here we have the Kenyan political party said, no, you can't send troops there. We can only send troops in the case of an agreement being signed. So the president said, okay, that's cool. And he went off and got an agreement signed with the Haitians. Of course, that government has now fallen. There's a transitional government, and that transitional government has ratified it. So in other words, in terms of Kenyan law, they can send their 200 police to Haiti. The problem with Haiti, and I was there when hundreds of thousands died in the after the earthquake, and I was there with the rescue group. And I mean, it really is a desperately poor country. The bandits that were in evidence then have now suddenly taken over that country completely. And an international operation, when you spoke about the United Nations not wanting to go into Mali and Burkina Faso and so on, the United Nations certainly don't want to go into Haiti. No. So when suddenly the Kenyans put their hands up and said, we'll go, we will spearhead an international police group. They're going to have about 1,000 police from Jamaica, Bahamas, Antigua, Barbuda, and other countries that will join later, hopefully. And they were supposed to be in place last week. But now the barracks that they've got to get, the vehicles they've got to get, all those things are about 75% ready, according to President Ruto when he was in Washington last week. Now, the United States and all the countries of the world who don't want to get involved in peacekeeping but are prepared to shell out, and that's the way peacekeeping is working these days, are giving $300 million to equip this police force. Of course, this the Haiti being in the Caribbean, not a million miles away from the United States.
So we've got a 3-week delay here already, and I know the place is being run, in inverted commas, by a monster called Barbecue, who apparently, among other things, has taken to roasting people in the streets on open flame. I mean, there's some seriously rotten stuff going on in Haiti. Somehow it is not, again, the world's focus that this absolute barbarism is taking place right there in the open on this supposedly free, liberated island. And it seems these poor people, the poor people of Haiti, just can't catch a break. Even if Kenya and Jamaica and Barbuda want to save them, it doesn't seem that it's possible.
You avoid the temptation of saying things are going from bad to worse in Haiti with Barbecue in charge. But it really is sad, you know. And I have to say, I have a special place in my heart for Haiti, having been there, having seen these people trying to recover from this terrible, terrible earthquake. You know, talking to the child. My job, I couldn't rescue people, couldn't rescue, myself. But the only thing I could do, because I speak French, was speak to the little children while they were having their bandages changed, and tell them nursery rhymes and things, so that they didn't cry too much. And so, you know, clearly I left a part of my heart in Haiti, and now to see these bandits or the gangsters simply taking it over really breaks my heart. So I greatly admire this the Kenyan efforts, and I think that Ruto's right. We can't go in half cock. We've got to have the equipment we need. We've got to have everything we need before we can go. Otherwise, you're going to send Kenyan policemen to their deaths. So maybe a 3-week delay. Barbecue, you know,
they'll be barbecued by barbecue.
Too bad.
I do think it's laudable that that Kenya are getting involved in international affairs, and you don't often hear it that a force of police or army or navy or whatever are being sent from Africa to somewhere else. It's usually the other way around. So that, in some ways, is a statement of intent. I just wish we could get it absolutely right. Otherwise, it does look like it's failure to launch.
Yeah, and it's not Kenya's fault. You know, as I say, we have the United States putting their $300 million up. They need the vehicles. They need to have proper housing for the soldiers, secure housing. Now, where are they going to keep their weapons? You need to put them. Need to have secure armory. Mm. Those sort of things. And Ruto sent an advance force to say, is it ready? And the guy said no, 75%. So the guys have all come home, and they'll be going back. Maybe in a week's time, have another look, and then we'll see the Kenyans there.
Ay, ay, ay. All right. Well, I mean, listen, it's a small light at the end of the tunnel compared to the other two stories you told us. So I'll take it. And you're going to vote this week, aren't you?
I believe I am. You know, we say in Pretoria, stem vroeg en stem dikwels. But I might only vote once in this.
All right. Well, I'd prefer it if you did. I mean, you're the guy who's been telling us about free and fair elections across the rest of the continent. It's only right that you yourself observe the rules, JJ Cornish.
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, I was telling you the story about the guys having to dip their fingers into indelible ink and then still try. And then in one of the African countries. I don't know why I'm having a senior moment, forgetting the name, but they just tried and tried again, and then they stick them on the back of trucks, arrested for trying to double vote, and they were all singing songs and enjoying it. It was in Somaliland, and then chewing on the cut. So it was a big day for them. You know, I don't know if we can have as much fun in our elections, but I hope we have as much enthusiasm.
I'm sure we will. JJ Cornish, it's a great pleasure to have you on. This is Africanalysis, which is brought to you every fortnight right here and on the podcast party with the Johannesburg Business School. You can find out more about them in the links. Just go and check it out in the comments and all the descriptions below. Thanks, JJ. We'll catch up with you in 2 weeks' time.
Looking forward to it.